Hi, this is Dave Spray, and I just recorded another edition of the IC Disc Show. This is one of the first editions we've done in some time because we've been on hiatus after COVID-19 started. But my guest today was Sheila Enriquez, the managing partner of the CPA firm Briggs & Veselka here in Houston. And this was a really amazing interview with really an amazing human being. Sheila's the first guest I've had who was not born in this country. And she just epitomizes really the American dream and the opportunities that are available in this country that some of us who are native born can forget. I certainly have to be careful to not take the opportunities this country offers for granted. But it's a wide-ranging interview talking about the accounting profession, her background, her story. Just her personal story is really just heartwarming. And I hope you enjoy this interview as much as I did.
David?
Hi, Sheila.
Hi,
good
how
morning.
Are you? Good morning.
So first of all, thank you for being a guest on the IC Disc Show.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for letting me be on.
So you're a unique guest. We've had the same guest on twice, but we've never had two guests from the same firm on two different episodes. So, but here, let me go ahead and get the background, and then I'll explain why you're the second one. So my guest today is Sheila Enriquez, the managing partner of the Texas-based CPA firm of Briggs & Veselka, which is a Houston-based CPA firm. And in the interest of full disclosure, I was an employee of the firm for several years, about 15 years ago. So why don't we start by just telling me about Briggs & Veselka, the history of it, and how long you've been there, and your role at the firm.
Oh, absolutely. I would love to have that opportunity. So Briggs & Veselka is the largest independent CPA firm in Houston. We currently have a little bit over 320 people now, but we started in 1973 with three people, and one of the co-founding partners is Johnny Veselka, who is the main partner. Started out historically as a tax firm and then grew to be the largest independent firm providing full service accounting services, including tax, audit, and financial consulting, and even technology consulting now in terms of offerings to our clients. So as a firm, really, we've evolved primarily because our more senior partners that started the firm, Johnny Veselka, John Fladowitz, who's one of the ones that I know you've interviewed previously, Steve Awalt, Charlie Weller, Gary Trocta, several others, that have started the firm and built it. Their vision was really to create a legacy firm that is committed to the community and committed to Texas specifically. So in that process, they've really done a great job over the years of creating a pipeline of leadership, and identifying services that enhance our relationship with our clients, providing value. And I personally started with the firm in 2007. So I've been with the firm now a little bit over 13 years. Started as a manager in the audit group. And in that, through my joining the firm, I really was able to take advantage of the opportunities that the senior partners at the time were offering up-and-coming managers and leaders within the firm. Very fortunate to have found a firm when I did because we were at a transition point. That was a time when Johnny Veselka was starting to look to transition his role as managing partner to John Fladowitz, who eventually took over, I believe, in 2009. And I remember in 07, when I first started, there might have been 80, 90 people. So it's a pretty incredible growth since we started, tripled really in number. Over the course of John's leadership, 8 years total, because I actually just celebrated my second year anniversary as managing partner yesterday. So,
congratulations.
It went by really quick. Thank you. Sure. It really went by super fast. But John, in his 8 years of, of leadership, has tripled the size of the firm, both revenue-wise as well as people-wise. And so he's really given me a huge gift, in terms of in transitioning from him as managing partner to me taking over. It set us up very nicely in putting forth a vision for what the next 10 years would look like. And part of that then is our goal to be, one of the largest independent firms in Texas, not just Houston. So we're the third largest currently. And I think the notion of independence is very important to us because it really allows us to preserve our culture that is very much a client-centric type of a culture, but very people-focused, so we start with our people first and giving them the right opportunities, leadership development, and also giving them paths that are more in line with their interests and that marry mm-hmm. within the needs of the firm too. So I am sort of that poster child, I would say, of that individual that came to the firm as an audit manager and evolved to become a partner that leads even our litigation support practice that I am very proud to have helped build within the firm. And it's one of our fastest growing areas now within the firm. It's a passion of mine. It marries my legal training. I'm an attorney as well. So my legal training with the audit background. Mm-hmm. And it's a great example, of somebody that was looking for a path that was unique to me. And I really just love my experience overall because that type of an opportunity is not unique to me. There are many, many mm-hmm. people in the firm, as you know, David, because you know our firm quite well, that have sort of found their own paths and created their own niches. And it's very rewarding. And it's sort of like being an entrepreneur within mm-hmm. the support structure, of a firm like Briggs & Viselka. So that's our firm, I don't know if that gives you, your listeners, a good flavor.
Does. And we'll delve into that, but I'm glad you brought up, that you highlighted the opportunities of, that the firm offers because, not only have you only been at the firm 13 years, that I know that you're not a native Houstonian and I think you moved to Houston just 13 years ago as well. Correct?
That's right. A little bit over, July 19, 2006, so 14 years, going on 14 years. Yeah.
Okay.
But yeah.
So, the reason I want to accentuate that, and then I know that you'd moved from New York, but what I don't recall is whether you were born in the U.S. or not.
Oh, okay. So I actually wasn't. I grew up in the Philippines. So I grew up in the Philippines, lived there, graduated high school there. And the reason why I actually had an opportunity to come to the United States was through a scholarship. So I was fortunate to be picked as one of 10 students that received a full scholarship, all expenses paid, through a very generous Japanese sponsor who actually paid for the 10 students, including myself, to study in an American college. It's State University of New York Feeder School in Lockshell, Drake, New York, so SUNY Sullivan County Community College. So I ended up taking that opportunity, which completely changed my trajectory because I was supposed to be a doctor. I was graduating from high school, already accepted at the University of the Philippines in the pretty much medical program. And I decided to take the opportunity for this great adventure. It was a 2-year program, a year and a half in Toyama, Japan, where the SUNY SCCC campus was located. And I actually ended up living with my sponsor. There were 2 girls and 8 boys. My husband was one of the 8 as well. So there were 2 of us that lived with a sponsor family. They had 2 daughters as well. So it was a wonderful experience. We got immersed completely in the culture, whereas the 8 boys had their own apartment. So, but it was a wonderful experience. Got to travel in Japan, got to spend a great time, learning the culture, still one of our favorite places. And we were supposed to go actually this year, June 10th, and go back and visit and take our kids, but you know, with the coronavirus, we had to cancel it. But then the last 6 months is at the New York campus.
Okay.
In upstate New York. So, but then the story continues, because what ended up happening is that we actually both ended up getting a scholarship to attend Mercy College, which is located in Dobbs Ferry, New York, Westchester County.
Okay.
So we transferred into that program. I ended up taking management, undergraduate in management, and my husband Jose pursued accounting. But as I was about to graduate with the undergraduate program, my last semester, I had three credits left for electives, and I ended up talking to the MBA, the dean of the graduate program of Long Island University, that happened to actually have a campus within Mercy
okay.
College as well. And I think it was a serendipity, really, but the dean, Wayne Shafari, ended up offering me a graduate assistantship to actually pursue my MBA, you know, for free, you know, in exchange for working 20 hours as his, you know, as his assistant, because he chose not to have a secretary. Yeah, so he ends up giving students, you know, opportunity, you know, high performing students opportunity to attend the program for free while working for him, rather than him hiring a secretary. So there were several of us that were in that pool.
Oh, what a great
and
strategy.
But you know, he changed my whole life, because in that process, I was graduating with a management degree, and he pretty much sold me on the idea of pursuing my CPA license, because
okay.
he developed this 4+1 program. He called it CPA MBA 4+1 program. I can still see the brochure in my head, but it was a
yeah.
pilot program that he was doing really ahead of the time, because that's a pretty common program now, you know, PP,
mm-hmm.
you know, the professional accounting program.
Yeah.
And so I took the opportunities. I ended up deferring my graduation and started taking graduate classes and undergraduate classes, mostly accounting undergraduate, to come
mm-hmm.
up with my undergraduate degree in public accounting, so I can take the CPA exam. And the rest is history, because I ended up passing the exam when I first took it, and it opened up a lot of doors for me to be able to actually stay in the U.S. under a working visa. And then, you know, my employer in Rhode Island sponsored me for my green card. So it's a bit of a long
okay.
story, but
no,
I think it's
it.
Really a story of serendipity and
well,
people opening doors for me. So that's been the story of my life.
Sure. Well, and I think you're being a bit too modest. It is a story of serendipity, but it's also, I think, a story of seizing opportunity. And
yes,
so obviously
absolutely.
You've made the most of it. And so I believe then the story then progresses from, so you were living in Rhode Island? Was that?
Yes.
Yeah, right?
I lived in New York for about 6 years, 5 or 6 years. So after finishing my undergraduate, Wayne to introduce me to my first employer, Brenner McDonough and Tortolani, which was an outsourced accounting CFO controller
okay.
firm focused on nonprofits. So really it starts with them in terms of my experience in financial consulting. But then one of the partners, Ed McDonough, was retiring, and he happened to be living in Rhode Island. So the firm itself, which is still in existence, they're focused on a niche market. It's Catholic religious, basically.
Okay.
And so they have offices all over the country. So New York was their main office, still is. And then they have an office in Rhode Island, Maryland, really all over the country. So there was an opportunity
okay.
to move to Rhode Island in 1998. And because neither my husband nor I have roots in New York, we were pretty adventurous, right? We were, why not? Let's
mm-hmm.
start over. Because Westchester County was so expensive, if you all aren't aware
sure.
of New York.
Yeah.
Yeah. New York is expensive, but Westchester is really up there, you know, in terms of.
Yeah. It's one of the affluent suburbs, right? Basically.
Exactly. I mean, that's where
mm-hmm.
Scarsdale is, and, you know, all these, pretty, you know, pretty affluent, like you said, people that work in the city, you know, they,
right.
they live there. But ultimately, we made the decision in 98 to not start over, but, you know, relocate to Rhode Island.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, so we ended up living there for actually 8 years in Rhode Island. And in that process, I made a decision shortly after we moved there to work for a CPA firm because I needed 500 audit hours to get my license. So even though I passed the exam in New York, I didn't have the experience, right? Because as a financial consultant, we weren't a CPA firm, right? So
right. So that you couldn't experience, get your hours.
Exactly. So I needed a year experience and 500 audit hours. And the plan really originally is, to your point about seizing opportunities, the plan really for me was to just get the hours and then, you know, and then potentially go back to my other firm, because it was so much more in a senior position than starting at a CPA firm where I started as a staff. So at that point, I already had a couple of years of experience. I literally started as a staff accountant, and they did every, you know, you go in there, it's a smaller firm, it's Sparrow Johnson and Yersillo. So I ended up doing everything. So I would do the audit, and then I would do the tax, and that would be at the corporate or partnership level. And then I would do the kids, you know, or the parents, and then the kids. I got so much exposure to many aspects of the business because it's a smaller firm, and my experience or lack thereof didn't stop my progression within the firm, which was great. So I was a staff for 3 months. They promoted me immediately to senior, you know, so it was one of those, just a perfect place for me at that time. You know, I stayed there for 8 years and, you know, had my first baby, you know, while working for them, started law school in the evenings while working for them. And they were very, very supportive, you know, throughout the whole process. So, ended up working for them through 2006, you know, and the reason why I left was primarily because my husband and I, Jose, decided to start over in Houston.
So, I know. I love this story because, as I understand it, you know, because you all both came from the Philippines, you didn't have, you know, quote unquote family in the U.S.
Right.
But
right.
You basically decided to make your own family, if you will, you know, by developing close friendships. So please continue with then how that brought you to Houston.
So I mentioned earlier that there were 10 students that, you know, were part of that scholarship program. And one of them is really my husband's best friend. His name is Mario Dominguez. So when he finished his associate's degree in New York with us, he ended up moving to Houston because his older sister and Chona, you know, she is a nurse and she works here in Houston. So I just remember throughout the years prior to us moving to Houston, we would come visit him, you know, because we're very close. He's really, his family is our family, you know, at the end of the day. So, you know, we were in his wedding party, we're the godparents to his oldest son, Josh. There, you know, he and his wife and Jeanette are the godparents to our oldest son, Anthony. So they're practically family, right? And they would come visit us in New York, you know, but they were in our wedding party when we got married in 2000. But there was just a point in time when, and it happened to be 05, 06 period, where Jose and I started thinking about where do we lay our roots, you know, because we decided we're going to stay in the U.S. and, you know, there are a lot of opportunities, but the reality is we didn't have any support. And by this point, Anthony was 2 years old. You know, I was in law school, attending in the evenings, working full time. You know, it was, I think that the turning point for me was when I was asked by the daycare, like, who's going to pick up Anthony, you know, if you're not there, you know, and I'm just like, I'm at a loss because all my friends are from work and school and they have older kids. And the neighborhood we lived in was an older neighborhood, you know, like there weren't really kids around. And so it got us thinking, you know, of, okay, when should we move? Because at two, Anthony will not remember it, right? He's going to be very adaptable. But if we waited, then it might be too late. So it literally was just a leap of faith. We looked at California because we do have distant relatives there. But, you know, Mario is such a close friend to us. And I think the one trigger for us too is it's so inexpensive. Like the cost of living here compared to Rhode Island. We looked at the house that they were building in Siena Plantation where we ended up moving. That's where I live now. I mean, I think it was like 3,000 square feet and brand new and, you know, master plan community. And this was in a long time ago when Siena was just starting. And I think it was like 175,000 or something.
Right.
something like that. It just was like mind boggling, you know, because that would be $1 million, you know.
Right. Well, and then you also throw in the lack of state income tax.
Exactly. Exactly. I think the one thing that we didn't even really expect that was such a great bonus was the fact that Houston is such a thriving business community, right? Again, right. We came here for our friends and really realized just how many opportunities there were and how warm the business community really has mm-hmm. been to me. You know, it's such an open and welcoming business community. I think a lot of us come from somewhere else and then found this very diverse, you know, I'm just so, so passionate about Houston.
Yeah, it's amazing. Yeah,
it's an amazing city.
So I've been here since 1987, since I graduated from the University of Texas in Austin with an accounting degree. But, you know, I say that people go, so many people I know, they go through several stages with Houston. First, yeah. they hate it, then they tolerate it, and then it just like seeps into you. You know, I say hate because like, yeah, I moved here from Austin, you know, smaller, you know, more geographically pretty place.
Right.
But you move here and at first you just see the people, the traffic, the, you know, the humidity. And, but what you realize over time and, is just how friendly and welcoming, not just the business community, the whole city is. And
yeah.
I have a theory on this because I've talked to a lot of people and I've lived in places a lot smaller. And the normal reputation is that small towns are friendlier than big cities. But if I use Houston as the big city example, I found that to not be the case. I found that smaller mm-hmm. towns are much more closed. It's I joke that, you know, I've lived in places where you could live in a house for 20 years and the neighbors still call your house the old Johnson house, you know,
exactly.
where it takes a while to really break in. And back in the late 80s, when I moved to Houston, there was a joke that really summarized how welcoming the Houston business community was. And the joke then was, mm-hmm. anybody with a cell phone and leased Mercedes could be a real estate developer in Houston. And,
yeah,
I mean, back when having a cell phone was, you know, a bigger deal. But yeah, I've always loved that. And that's why, and that kind of dovetails to my thing of, you know, not only are you an American success story, but you're a Houston success story, because I can't imagine there's many cities that you could move to and not be from the community. Like friends I have that live in Dallas tell me this would have been harder. You know, that Dallas is a more closed community. If you didn't grow up in Highland Park and you didn't go to SMU, that it's,
right.
But Houston is just so meritocratic
right.
that it really, when you think about it, right, you move here, you have no business contacts, no roots, no mm-hmm. family reputation. And right. in 10 years, you not only get promoted several times, you're the leader of the largest, independent CPA firm. Is it in Texas? Are you the largest in Texas now? Or is it?
We're the third largest. We're the third largest independent in Houston, but okay. We're the largest in Houston. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you're absolutely right, David. I mean, I pinch myself. Like, you know, I was talking to our new employees the other day and I was telling them about just the many, many opportunities that they can have in the firm and, you know, paving their own path. And I mean it, right? Because I am that person that lived through it. And I think it's a testament to finding the right place and the right organization, mm-hmm. you know, that is very inclusive, that is really, to your point, very meritocratic, you know, what is it that you can deliver, right? And so it's been such a wonderful ride for me. And to your point about certain communities being very insular, and this is not a knock, right? I think what happens is when you do have a smaller community, and I grew up in one, you know, my hometown in the Philippines is Baguio City, 350,000 people now, which is a lot more than when I was going up there. it does tend to be very tribal, very insular, you know, like who do you know? And it's hard to kind of penetrate relationships. And I kind of felt that way a little bit in Rhode Island. You know, Rhode Island is a very small state. So I moved from the smallest state to the largest state. You know, you can, I think you can fit Rhode Island probably on Beltway 8. It's such a small state.
Yeah.
And it's beautiful. It's a beautiful, you know, state. And I built so many, many close friendships, you know, living there. But it is one of those, you know, where people don't rarely move, right? From, they grew up there. Their friends are there.
Right.
Childhood friends, you know, and I think Houston just is a melting pot. You know, we all come from, not all, but, you know, a lot of people come from somewhere else. And my inclination, right, is to embrace people that come from somewhere else,
right,
too, because I've been there and I want to help and I want to tell them just how amazing the city is, you know. And I think it almost becomes this pay it forward mentality. So, and it creates this wonderful environment then for people to want to come to. And of course, for me and my husband, we grew up in the Philippines. So, you know, I'm not as used to the humidity as he is, but it was one of those things where we still liked, I still like warmer weather than dealing with the snow in Rhode Island and
sure,
New York.
Sure.
So I do miss the fall, though. I miss the fall season. But
sure. I'm from Iowa originally, you know, for the first 13 years of my life. I have a saying that says the worst Houston summer is still better than the best northern winter is my theory. Because at least this time of year in the evenings, you know, when the sun's starting to set, it's pleasant. I mean, you can actually walk around and be outside, and during the day you're in air conditioning, and so it's not so bad.
Yeah, that's the one aspect people forget unless you actually have lived, you know, in the East Coast, is that, you know, we didn't have central air conditioning. We had a window air conditioning, and they have heat waves there too. So, you know, I would hang out in the basement, you know, whenever we have those, you know, 100 degree days. So, you know, it's really just, it's how you look at it. I feel like, you know, the heat is really just bothersome when you're going from their house to the car to your building, you know? And then you can pick your day of, you know, like you said, 8 o'clock at night, it tends to be pretty comfortable. So it's just a longer day too. I feel like you can do more because with the winter, it tends to be, for me anyway, you know, that it starts in November, right? It gets cold, dark, and then it'll be a while before you see spring.
So you get off work and it's dark in the winter.
Right.
So you're not really motivated to go do much, you know, except go home. And it's interesting. The part you mentioned about Rhode Island. My other observation is I think it's a function of the growth rate, I think, as much as anything else, because I've been to other large cities like Milwaukee, Chicago, Philadelphia, that has those same elements of the smaller communities. That you go to a place like Philadelphia, and I think a much larger percentage of the residents of Philadelphia were born in Philadelphia. And when you look at growth rates and, you know, like I tell people from Houston, I said, like, if you go to a place like Philadelphia, the average age of a house there is probably 80 years old.
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly.
Right? Because the population hasn't grown much, so there's not much need to build new houses. And so you keep just, you know, keeping the old ones. And on the other hand, I tell folks not from, you know, from one of those northern cities that hasn't had the growth. I said the average age of a house in Houston metro area is probably less than 20 years old.
Oh,
they're
you're
like, how can that be? And I'm like, we don't do a great job with our history. You know, if a house does get to be 50 years old, we tear it down and put up a new one. And because our construction costs are so relatively low here and there's not a lot of regulation, that it's much easier to for a neighborhood to transition than I think some of other, like, northern cities where there's just a higher regulatory environment. So,
amazed because the value of land, I think, is what makes the difference. And I think a lot of it is also also maybe the fact that Texas is a lot bigger, right? And so there's more land compared to just, you know, if you pick any one of the major cities,
sure.
New York, Chicago, you know, even LA for that matter. But what I've found though is that the quality of life, at least for us, is just so much better when you're raising a family, because we decided to move to Santa Plantation because the main reason why we wanted to move here was because of Jose's best friend. And mm-hmm. we didn't look at any other neighborhood, right? Because we love Siena. It has everything. It's a master plan community, which is not common at all, you know, in the East Coast. You know, I can't think of one off the top of my head, you know, where you
and they're
have
everywhere.
A neighborhood.
They're everywhere.
Here is very
there's
common.
There's at least
yes,
20 I can think of off of just the top
exactly.
of my head. I've held there's you're and just to give you an idea, people not from Houston, Siena Plantation's about 20 miles to the southwest of downtown, 25 miles,
yes.
something
mm-hmm.
like that.
But 20, yeah, give or take, yeah.
Yeah, and it's in what's called the Sugar Land general area. But there's probably a dozen master plan communities just out on the southwest side of Houston.
Absolutely. And to have all the amenities within your, you know, just within your reach, you know, we have a golf course, 3 water parks, 2 gyms, you know, all the
right.
elementary schools are pretty good schools. It just is such a different environment, you know, and I have a 17-year-old and a 10-year-old. And this is something I wanted to mention too, because speaking of serendipity, so my best friend since I was 5 ended up also coincidentally moving to Houston in 2008, like the same time that I'm
oh,
sorry,
wow.
When did I, actually, it was actually sooner than that. Cause we moved here in 06, they ended up actually moving a few months before we even did just
oh, wow.
as a coincidence. Yes. Her name is Veronica and she, you know, and so now she lives like 2 minutes from me also in Siena. So it's just
wow.
an amazing support group that we've created, you know, and
sure.
it's supplemented that with additional families. But it's such a wonderful neighborhood that when she was looking for a house, because they were renting when they first moved here, when her husband took a position with Halliburton, he actually, you know, I told her, you can't look at any other neighborhood. You got to look at Siena. And so she did. And
because
then,
selfishly,
yes,
you wanted her nearby, right?
Absolutely. Because her oldest is the same age. Kenzo is the same age as my oldest. And her two, she's got 3 boys. But her 2 boys, you know, my little one, Jacob, is sort of in the middle of them. Because her second one is 14. And then her youngest one is 8. So it's just an amazing story, you know, that we all kind of got together. And she's family. She really is like my sister. So it's just been an amazing. But this neighborhood has been so good to us, too. You know, we love it. We love this neighborhood.
That is awesome. Well, thank you for being so so willing to share your personal story, because I think it's just a great reminder, you know, for those of us born in this country, like me, you kind of just take the country for granted. We fail to recognize the specialness and the immense opportunity that the country offers. And so it's always great to hear that perspective.
And I do want to echo you on that and emphasize that, you know, I do feel like, you know, I'm a testament. We are, you know, my husband and I are both testament to just the American dream, you know, where if you work hard enough, and this is why I'm also very passionate about education, because education is what led me to where I am today. You know, that opportunity
mm-hmm.
that was given to me by a very generous, you know, philanthropist that just wanted to help, you know, just completely changed my trajectory. And it's really very humbling to think about kind of the path and where I am now. But so I'm
mm-hmm.
super, super committed to paying that forward. I'm very focused on, you know, being involved in educational organizations, and then also just for the firm as well, you know, being able to tell people about the CPA designation and just how special it is. You know, this profession
mm-hmm.
to me is just something very special that can open up so many doors. If we have any listeners out there that are thinking about what major they might want to take in college,
sure.
I can talk all day long about why you need to pursue, you know, a CPA.
Well, and there's a great opportunity, right? Because a significant number of the current CPAs will be retiring, I believe, in the next
exactly.
10 years, isn't that right? So there's
exactly.
a great opportunity. Well, and
I remind
of that, oh, go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead.
Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I remind our associates, you know, that we're very blessed, because even in the midst of this unprecedented crisis, you know, we are an essential business. And I think CPAs are really able to help, you know, our clients navigate through a lot of the new legislation and a lot of financial issues that are coming up. So if you're looking for a purpose, I mean, there's no, to me, you know, it's really one of those professions that will definitely, you can find your purpose in helping, you know, other people.
For sure. And just, you know, speaking of that, what, you know, I'm not up to date on these numbers like you are, but what are the general, you know, kind of range of starting salaries for people who, you know, go into public accounting with an accounting degree?
Sure. We start off, give or take, mid-50s for, you know, for staff accountants.
That's great.
Yeah, which I think is a pretty good starting point. And then from there, you know, it can really go up depending on the level, right? It actually can be very lucrative once you start looking at, you know, pursuing perhaps a partnership, you know, in a firm, because it's one thing about public accounting firms is that if you end up going down that path, right, it's more of a business that is based on what you bring in terms of the time that you put it. So it's a profit type of a role, because you're delivering a service. And there's a value to the service that you're putting out. Now, if you decide to go the industry route, there's also a good progression that you can have there, you know, starting out as a staff accountant, senior, picking a direction that you want to take, and then maybe playing the role of a CFO, you know, controller. And I think because you're in the numbers, you know, you're always at the table, you know, you're always part of the decision maker. So the potential for compensation goes up, I think, as you hit the manager level, and then you start to kind of progress from there. But if from a job security perspective, I also talk about that quite a bit, because it is an essential role. I think there's a good job security, you know, that comes with it.
No, I would agree. So, what I'd like to do now is just talk a bit about the characteristics of the companies who seem to really be the best fit for your firm. So my sense is that like a Fortune 100 company is not the best fit, that, you know, their audit, you know, the market may prefer that one of the, you know, large international firms do their audit. But on the other hand, at the size you're at now, I'm guessing that your focus is not on trying to crank out, you know, 10,000, you know, 1040s for a few hundred dollars each. So talk to me about who you really are best set up to serve, the types of companies and individuals.
Sure. Yeah. So I had mentioned earlier that we have evolved the services of the firm, you know, to expand it so that we're actually hitting a lot of the needs of our client base. And our client base has also evolved over the years. But basically, I could probably characterize it as the middle market clients is what we're targeting, you know, middle market businesses. And of course, middle market is a fairly large, you know, range. So it could be, you know, businesses with 20 million in revenues all the way to half a billion. Our sweet spot, though, I would say, where we are now is 20 million to maybe about 100 million, if not over.
Yep.
But we're starting to kind of move up market as well, simply because we're creating niche practices that also can help larger organizations. You know, for instance, we're creating a fairly robust consulting practice. We've already created it. It was initially started in banking with internal audit and financial consulting.
Yeah, David Phelps. But really,
David Phelps, exactly. Exactly. So, but now we're actually able to serve even those that are in billion-dollar private middle market companies, because they may not hire us for the audit, but they may hire us for the consulting piece. You know, so whether they're preparing for the audit, so that we're now helping them through technical accounting issues or internal controls or any kind of maybe process improvement that they may be looking at. So even though our target market for our audit, I would characterize as 20 million to maybe 500 million. If I look at our tax group, that has also a different range, because for our tax folks, we still do individuals for sure.
Right.
But those are mostly, they have complex issues, you know, it's not one where it's just a simple 1040, but rather, you know, they have a business, they're still a solo proprietor, or, you know, there's more complexity in their taxes. So we've started to really build what we call niche areas, so that we can create a team that is focused on a particular expertise, be a subject matter expert, whether that's in an industry or a service line. But the big thing that we're doing right now is the collaboration across the firm, so that it's not a siloed approach in servicing our clients. So we're looking for the ideal client for us is one where we're able to help them with the audit and then help them with the tax as well, you know, tax planning, and then also help the individual owners, you know, to help navigate through a lot of the, you know, maybe it's exit planning and trying to sell their business, or, you know, tax planning and creating an estate plan or a gifting plan, you know. So it's really more of a comprehensive, you know, comprehensive service. So because of that, I think our ideal client really falls in the entrepreneurial category, you know, owners that are opening their businesses, they have a high growth company that they're excited about. They're looking for a partner, not just to do the compliance, but to really help them navigate through the challenges and connect them, you know, with the right resources. So you know this about us, David, because you've been with our firm, and that was the role that you played. We'd like to think of ourselves as truly that trusted advisor that connects, you know, our clients to the right resources, whether that's us or somebody else that we can refer to them, because it's
like a banker, outside. Like a bank,
right?
A law firm,
exactly. Exactly. So yeah, so we're pretty industry agnostic, even though we're building these industry verticals. You know, we have manufacturing, construction, you know, real estate. We even have a huge banking practice. We have about 50, more than that, 50 plus banks now that we work with. You know, so we've realized over the course of the evolution of the firm that there is now an opportunity to really create these verticals, you know, that is servicing the industry, but also expanding the services then, you know, that we offer within each of the core audit, tax, and consulting.
Yeah, in fact, I think one of your first niches, even before you joined the firm, was the benefit plan auditing.
Yes.
And I think, I assume that's still probably a significant niche for you all.
It is. And, you know, kudos to Marisa Morgan. You know, Marisa, she started that practice from the ground up, you know, and I think right now we're close to maybe 150, you know, that we do audits. And we're definitely in the top, you know, percentage of firms in the nation, you know, that do the number of EBP plans. And Marisa has done a really, really good job of building the succession as well. So we have several senior managers and principals that are helping her build that practice. So we see that as a very sustainable and continuing niche for us. Very excited. And what's nice is that we also have built up the team, even at the lower level, seniors and staff that are very passionate about that area and would like to see themselves developing, you know, within that niche. Yeah.
No, that sounds good. I can't believe how quickly the time has passed. So there's a couple of last things I'd like to talk about before we wrap up. And one is, I would like to talk about some of the misconceptions people have about the accounting industry or the public accounting industry. And then I'd also like if you could give me a real life example or two of companies or individuals that just come to mind, just an example of someone that you were able to help, you know, maybe somebody who had, who was with a very small firm they'd outgrown, or somebody who had been with a very large firm that they weren't getting the personal service. So if you could just touch on those two things, why don't we start with maybe some of the you know, biggest misconceptions people have about the public accounting industry.
Yeah, and thank you for that opportunity. I didn't expect that to be a question, but I'm so glad that you bring it up. And I think it's very, very timely, because we're talking about that in the profession. You know, I'm very active with the profession itself, at the local, state, and national level. So I think you may know I served as the president of the Houston CPA Society a couple of years ago, and I'm currently on the executive board of the state society, and I'm actually the chair of the branding and community relations committee, which is a new committee that we created for this year. And I also just served 3 years on the governing council of the AICPA, and I'm rolling back in next year. So one of our biggest hurdles, right, as I'd mentioned to you before, is that, we believe in the profession. I believe in it wholeheartedly. I feel like there's so many opportunities. But there is this perception about accountants, I think, that is out there for whatever reason. And I had it, too, right? And that's why I went management in the first place. My husband went accounting, but I went management because in my mind, oh, gosh, accounting, it's boring.
You know, right, bean counter,
bean
green
counter,
shade,
I'm just,
green eye
right,
shade.
Every time we're portrayed in the movies, it's usually like this person that has like a half part or, you know, it's like,
yeah.
So I think essentially that you have an image issue is how I put it, you know.
Sure.
And I think it's compounded by the fact that we also have busy seasons, you know, where,
right.
you know, some of the students may be thinking, gosh, you know, if I want work-life balance, I cannot achieve that, right, in the CPA realm and in the public accounting realm, because they work 80-hour weeks during busy season, you know, from January through April. And, you know, there are firms, obviously, that have that, you know, where there is that need, and maybe you do work a lot of hours. But I think it really is a misconception. You know, if you look at the opportunities that CPAs have, just in the diversity of the opportunities, you know, so I mentioned to you, as a firm, we have our core services of audit, tax, and consulting. But if you're coming in as a practitioner, you know, as a staff, there's so many exposure that you can have in these different areas, because even within tax, you can be doing personal taxes, you can be doing corporate taxes, you could be doing partnerships, international tax, high net worth, estate planning, right? So you can pick a path, you know, that is of interest to you within tax. And then if you look at audit, in the same token, you know, you can pick an industry, you can say, you know, I want to learn how to audit oil and gas companies, real estate companies, construction, and then even within that, you get trained to be a consultant. So you can become a controller, you can become a forensic accountant, which is essentially what I ended up gravitating towards, you know, where you actually do investigations, and I testify in court, you know, to calculate damages involving commercial litigation. And then you throw in technology, you know, technology is a big piece of what we do as CPA firms, where we actually implement, you know, systems, enterprise systems like SAP and, you know, Oracle. So you have the technology piece. And even as we deliver our services, we use data analytics. We're into artificial intelligence now. We talk about blockchain. So there's such a broad opportunity, right, depending on your interest. So we're not just here sitting, calculating and preparing tax returns, or it really is a very exciting and continuing to evolve profession, very centered on helping clients, right? And so whatever the client's needs are when it comes to financials, we're there and we can help them. And then it even goes beyond that operationally, you know, operational excellence, you know, visioning, creating a plan for the future, strategic planning, implementation, you know, that's our role, you know, as advisors. So I really would love to change the image, you know, that we have out there of the stoic, you know, cannot converse because we're boring. I mean, at the end of the day, what is the number one, to me, right? The number one requirement to be successful in our profession is the ability to communicate. Because every day we're communicating with our clients, with our staff, with the community, you know, whether that's written, whether that's verbal. So, you know, if you are looking for a really solid profession that you can you can develop yourself and then become a leader too. I think being a CPA is really one that you should be thinking about. And then I want to just touch on real quick the work-life balance issue. It's real, right? I mean, but you know what? I look at any profession out there though, and it's the same situation, right? A lawyer, an engineer, you know, you name it. I mean, work-life balance is just a universal issue. It's not a CPA, it's not an accountant issue.
Right.
What I tell people though about that is you've got to find the right organization that can provide you with the work-life balance. And I'm very fortunate because that was my number one requirement when I moved to Houston. So when I moved to Houston, I didn't know any firms in the area. I relied on my recruiter. But my number one requirement was work-life balance because I had a two-year-old that, you know, my oldest was two at the time, and I was going to transfer into the University of Houston Law Center to pursue my law degree in the evenings, right? So I needed to have an employer.
In your free time, with all that free time, go ahead and go to law school, right?
Exactly. So I needed to find an employer that actually understood what I was looking for, that recognized that I can deliver, you know, but they have to give me the flexibility. And you would probably be surprised, or maybe not, to learn that certain firms just weren't open to that, right? They offered me a part-time position because they thought, well, how can you really do that, right? But Briggs & Piszczalka said, yeah, go for it, right? Because that's just better for us as a firm because, you know, once you graduate, you know, and that's what happened, you know, I started our litigation support practice and so I think to me, don't let that keep you from pursuing, you know, the CPA license, because if anything, it gives you the credibility and the leverage to work with your employer in creating a more balanced schedule, because I don't think it's a woman's issue either. I mean, it may seem that way, but I do know that millennials in particular, they're, you know, the dads want to get involved, right? It's not that boomers didn't or Gen Xers didn't, but when I started, there wasn't really that expectation, right? It's almost like we had to live within the structure that we found ourselves in, which is really interesting to me because I never questioned the hours when I started in public accounting until I had Anthony. And then I said, I'm only going to work 4 days with my former employer in Rhode Island. They were like, sure, you know. It's really finding, I think, the right employer too is so critical. But they share your values. So if the value is family and finding a work-life balance, then find that employer that actually embraces that, you know. And then if you're one that is just really wants to put in the hours, work really hard, and maybe at a stage in your life, find that employer as well, you know, that fits that value. So it's really not a right or wrong, but I certainly want to just emphasize, and I know for Briggs, we're very, very committed to allowing our people to have flexibility. We're all working remote right now. All 320 plus people, we're all working remote, working from home because of the COVID crisis. But even before, we were letting people work from home some days of the week. So, you know, I think it's important to find the employer. So please consider.
That is great.
Truly is a very good one. And then I think you were asking if we have some clients that maybe we've helped, you know.
So here's where you get to really. Yeah. So here's a great opportunity with one or two examples, maybe just one because of time, that can illustrate and really allow you to, you know, to accentuate some of the positives of the firm with a real world story. And it, you know, it could be a, You know, probably a textbook one would, you know, maybe be some entrepreneurial company that had, you know, so anyway, but just, you know, if there's an example that comes to mind, would love to.
Well, I've got one. Yeah. So I've got one, and it's not a specific company per se, but I think it reflects our core, you know, core mission of really assisting our clients. Right. And because generally speaking, I can give you examples of situations where we would actually get a client that maybe outgrew their CPA and they're now involved in, say, international tax issues because they're growing. Mm-hmm. And we would tend to bring them in and then realize, you know, that there are mistakes that were done or things that were not, you know, we're not even filed, but we can now help them remedy, you know, those are fairly common, you know, in sure. terms of being able to assist them. But the one thing that actually comes to mind for me that is pretty recent is this payroll protection program, right? These stimulus packages that were put out mm-hmm. very quickly as a response to COVID. And I think for our firm, our focus is always how do we help our clients, you know? And so right. in a situation where they're struggling, right? What do I do? You know, all of a sudden I had revenues one month and then I have zero the next, right? And they want to protect their employees because a lot of our clients are similar to our core. They're very people focused. And mm-hmm. so when the PPP program came out, you know, we really took the time within a few days to digest it, understand it, and figure out a way to help our clients. And the best thing that we did in hindsight, which, you know, in the moment, right, I just remember, I think the legislation was finalized. President Trump signed it, I think, on a Friday. And we had a task force ready, you know, ready to kind of take it in, figure out a way for us to push this out to the clients, and then figure out a way to help them. So the mm-hmm. following Monday, we actually mocked up a webinar to be able to reach our clients and give them the specifics, you know, of the program. And if you've been staying on top of the PPP, it's an ever changing, right? Very fluid situation where you think one thing as defined, and then they come, you know, the SBA comes out with new definitions, and so the need to actually be on top of it is so crucial. But long story short, we ended up putting out a webinar back to back within 2 days, where we had over 1,000 people attend in that 2 day session, and then we added another one that Friday for nonprofits specifically, because nonprofits, that's mm-hmm. really an area that we're also building out. And I was really, really proud of the team and the feedback that we got from the clients, you know, because again, it was happening so quickly and the opportunity to apply was, there was such a short window, you know, to yep. think about the funds initially that ran out, you know, until it was right. replenished. So, you know, that to me was a huge thing. And I remember because we send out, at the time we were sending out daily communication to the firm, you know, the challenge that I asked the team was, you got to step up, right? This is the time. This is the time to help clients answer questions, put them in the right direction in terms of what they need to, you know, to do in order to make this happen. And really our connections worked well for us too, because the banks were in a tough position to respond. You know, I don't really recall, mm-hmm. but certain banks were only offering it to their clients. So if you happen to be a client that doesn't have a relationship with a bank just yet, you could be out in the cold. Right. So we helped so many of them get connected with our community banks that really were not partial to, you know, just their clients, you know, and so mm-hmm. being able to connect them. And really that's been a few months now, and we're now in the phase of the forgiveness. And we're continuing to help. We're continuing to push out information every time there's an update. You know, that task force has evolved into a niche group that's actually helping clients with not just their application, but their forgiveness, you know, application as well. I think it's a testament, you know, to our ability to really pivot and address, you know, issues as they come. It's very client focused and being able to provide that resource to them beyond compliance.
Yeah, well, thank you for that explanation. And that turnaround time from the legislation being signed Friday to having a game plan by Monday is, not every service organization responded that quickly.
And by the way, we've never done a webinar in the history of the firm. So that was
new. Oh, wow. You had to get that figured out in a hurry.
We piloted it with the internal people first. And thankfully, we implemented Zoom last year. And by the time Zoom took off as like the, you know, the media of choice, we were already pretty well versed in it and had a good relationship with Zoom. So, you know, I think our license was capped at 500 for the attendance. And then we started getting registrations, and there were So we ended up expanding it to 1,000. But just, you know, again, it still amazes me kind of, I'm so proud of the team, you know, that made it happen. But that's the one that keeps resonating with me when you ask me the question.
Well, that is great. Well, thank you for sharing that. And I can't believe our hour is already up. This has been a real treat for me, Sheila. And again, I just want to reiterate how my heart is warmed by your American success story and your Houston success story. That just is really, really inspiring and a reminder to really every native born American about just what a tremendous opportunity this country provides. And so thank you for demonstrating that that opportunity exists. And also thank you for taking such good care of our clients. We share some clients, and so thank you for the good job you guys do. I don't know if you know, we just picked up a client that a bank referred us that you all do their audit work, and I can talk offline
about
it.
Great.
But thank you
to you for, I know you've always been a huge supporter of the firm as well. So, you know, always appreciate you keeping us in mind and the relationship. You know, I'm hoping by the time we get to January next year, we can have the open house, because I know that's usually a time that we get to catch up. But I really just appreciate the opportunity to talk about the firm and myself too.
Well, it was my pleasure. Well, thank you again for your time, and have a great week.
You too. Thank you, David. Bye-bye.
Bye.
There we have it. Another great episode. Thanks for listening in. If you want to continue the conversation, go to icdiscshow.com. That's icdiscshow.com. And we have additional information on the podcast, archived episodes, as well as a button to be a guest. So if you'd like to be a guest, go select that and fill out the information, and we'd love to have you on the show. So that's it. We'll be back next time with another episode of the IC Disc Show.